I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today it's Midday with the Mayor. Baltimore City Mayor Catherine Pugh joins me for the hour. She's nominated Joel Fitzgerald, the police chief in Fort Worth, Texas, to take the reins of the beleaguered Baltimore City Police Department. A delegation from the city council traveled to Fort Worth last week to ask people there what they thought of Dr. Fitzgerald. Has he been vetted thoroughly? Has the hiring process been transparent? Can a police chief coming into an agency from out of town turn around a department that's been racked by corruption and which is operating under a consent decree? The police are just one of the arrows in the mayor's violence reduction quiver. The intervention program Safe Streets is expanding as another anti-violence program, ROCA, gets underway. We'll get underway with Mayor Catherine Pugh when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today it's Midday with the Mayor. Baltimore City Mayor Catherine Pugh joins me here in Studio A. She has nominated Dr. Joel Fitzgerald, the current police chief in Fort Worth, Texas, to be Baltimore's new police commissioner. If the city council confirms him next month, he will take over a department that is still reeling from frequent leadership changes and a demoralized rank and file among corruption scandals. This morning, Daryl D'Souza, who served as commissioner for about 4 months earlier this year, pled guilty to federal tax charges in federal court for not filing his federal tax returns in 2013, 2014, and 2015. As for Mayor Pugh's efforts to reduce violence in Baltimore, the Safe Streets program is adding three more locations around town. ROCA, a violence interruption program based in Boston, is now up and running here. Mayor Pugh also points to the Neighborhood Impact Investment Fund, which she has long championed, as another initiative aimed at transforming economically depressed areas of our city. On Saturday, the mayor attended a ceremony celebrating three new Habitat for Humanity homes in Sandtown, Winchester. We'll take your calls and comments a little later in our broadcast. For now, you are welcome to ping us on Facebook, where we are broadcasting and streaming our conversation here with Mayor Pugh. Madam Mayor, happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Tom. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. So let's talk a little bit about the process that you underwent in the your decision to nominate Joel Fitzgerald as the police chief. Give us an idea of your conversation with him. What kinds of questions ask him?
Let me begin with the process, because the process began, you know, almost as soon as Mr. D'Souza resigned. We met with the PERF, the Organization of Professional Executives, police organization, to talk about what we were looking for. And so that took place in April. And then in April, they assured us that they could work with us to help us to find a police chief. And so they invited me in May to Nashville, Tennessee, where there was a national organization meeting of police officers, because they wanted to introduce me to some police chiefs around the country who might be interested in applying for the position. In fact, they introduced me to seven police chiefs, and one now is was an interim in Seattle, is now the police chief in Seattle. One was out of Atlanta, who is now the public safety over police and fire there. And I encouraged at least four of those individuals to apply, and two of them did. And so then we opened up the process so that we could get applications from around the country. And I think we got altogether close to 50 applications. Once the 50 applications came in, I should also say that in Nashville, there were, I think, was seven police chiefs from around the nation who sat down with me to talk about what they thought I should be looking for in a police chief, and including our own consultant, Sean Malnikowski from LA, who is still a consultant for the Baltimore City Police Department and had worked with us through the Department of Justice. And so they also agreed to sit on a panel in Miami once the applications were reviewed. And they were reviewed by myself and our city solicitor, Sean Malnikowski, and the president of the city council, where we went through all of the applications and listed them. And we had three applications from Baltimore. And so those three applicants, along with, I think, 7 to 10 other folks, were interviewed in Miami this past, I think it was September. And then there were recommendations. They listed the top candidates, and Fitzgerald was the choice that I made to go before the city council. In city council's on break now, so they don't meet again until January.
And that's when they'll take up the confirmation.
Right.
And of course, a delegation from the city council just traveled to Fort Worth this last weekend to talk to folks down there about their impressions of Dr. Fitzgerald. He holds a PhD. I'm interested. I mean, you got the counsel from the police chiefs around the country about the right. Kinds of characteristics you're looking for in mm-hmm. a new chief. What kinds of questions did you ask him? And conversely, what kinds of questions did he ask you?
Well, they asked most of the questions. I was introduced and, wanted to know a little bit about the background, where they came from, why they the police, how they interacted as a police chief, why they would pursue a position in Baltimore, was basically the same questions that I asked all seven candidates that I had opportunity to talk with. And most of them were interested in urban policing, had experience in changing organizations, and was interested in bringing the change that Baltimore needed to see, understood that we had a consent decree and we're under one. There were few who had already read the consent decree, so that was a plus for them, including Fitzgerald, and understood that we needed to get more engagement by our police department, and that there was a need to look at the totality of the police department and the makeup of the police department and how we could get officers more engaged and trained to meet the needs of our community.
Dr. Fitzgerald's resume, it says that he's got experience in procedural restorative justice.
Yeah.
That's a philosophy. It's kind of a buzzword
these days. But it's also used in the consent decree.
Mm-hmm. And so what does that mean to you? What does restorative justice mean to you, and how does that fit into the dynamics of what the police department can eventually be under leadership of a new person?
Well, I think what we're talking about is what the police department is currently doing now, and that is being more community engaged and being aware of everybody's rights as a citizen and to interact with people with respect and to proceed in such a way that we don't break the laws.
He also talks about his experience in predictive policing and CompStat. CompStat is, we have a similar system here. It was put in place by, I think, Mayor O'Malley back in the day.
Well, actually, it was put in place by Martin O'Malley, and we've expanded on it. And, the thing that I always say is that every mayor should want the next mayor to do more than what they were able to do. And so we've created the Office of City Stats Sustainable Solutions, where we look at problems, not just the data, but look at how do we improve our own operations based on the data that we collect. The predictive analysis program is something that we now, through Sean Malinowski, and the Department of Justice have implemented in the East and the West. We should be expanding it across the city. But it's a way to look at crime data and project what's going to happen in various areas, whether it is using ShotSpotter, which we now have. I should say gunshot detection. ShotSpotter itself is a name of a
right.
company.
So when shots are fired,
you can pretty much predict
that information goes directly to the
right.
department.
Mm-hmm. And then also how you're utilizing your cameras and surveying communities and neighborhoods in such a way that we can make sure that police are able to arrive on the scenes more quickly. So that's what that does. And he has had experience in that and has placed it in the cities in which he's been.
And on the other hand, there are people who are long concerned with, and this is part of the consent decree and the Department of Justice report that came out in August of a couple of years ago, about racial profiling. So
Absolutely.
Predictive policing and racial profiling, what's the distinction?
No, the predictive policing is around ShotSpotter areas where crime occurs and when a shot is fired, how you would know where to go. Cameras are placed in such a way that you can see the area. This is not about people or persons.
There are those who have criticized the process of Mr. Fitzgerald's nomination as not being transparent enough. They were looking for an open search process. They point to cities around the country who've, published the names of the top three candidates or the top four candidates. These people come in places like Seattle, Charleston, St. Louis, Ferguson, Missouri, when they hired their last police chief, even Los Angeles, where Sean Malinowski comes from. They say that it's better to get buy-in from people in the community at the very beginning of the process. You chose not to pursue that approach.
Well, let me just say that that is not what has happened in those other areas as well, because in fact, when they had the open process in Seattle, the police chief that currently is the police chief was not the selected police chief. In fact, applied elsewhere because she wasn't selected because of the process that took place. She is now the police chief because of a closer process that worked for them better. And so it does not always work. And in fact, what happens is, and this is what we were told by the experts, is that what you will get are deputies and so forth. And we wanted a police chief. And they said that if you were looking for a police chief, you should have a process that allows police chiefs who have jobs in other cities to apply. Only if you are a police chief or an interim in a certain area would you apply. Otherwise, you would jeopardize your own position in the city in which you're coming from.
So it would just, it would limit the pool of candidates
exactly.
if they had to, because they didn't obviously want to have, you know, their current employer knowing
that
they're looking
searching.
Elsewhere. I mean, how did, what happened when the mayor of Fort Worth appeared to send a tweet saying that Joel Fitzgerald was going to come to Baltimore and be the police chief, and this was some weeks before you actually nominated him?
Yeah, it created, you know, it created some concern there as it relates to, you know, whether he would leave or not leave. In fact, there were a group of folks there who asked if the city would match his salary in Baltimore and to try to keep him there.
And that's now behind you? I mean, Dr. Fitzgerald is good to go and fully committed. I mean, I understand he's keeping his job in Fort Worth in case something doesn't, things don't work out in the confirmation process.
No, that was the commitment that he had made to the city, because they, you know, did not want it disrupted as quickly as they thought it could be. And they asked him if he would commit to being there until the process.
Your offer to him, I understand, will be a 5-year offer. Various people have various understandings of what it takes to how long it takes for, you know, true, consistent, significant change to be implemented. Some people say 3 is okay.
Some say 5. Some say
7. I mean,
sure.
The current interim commissioner, Commissioner Tuggle, says 7. He says, as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons he didn't apply. He didn't think he had that many more years working in him. So, I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you believe that Dr. Fitzgerald will commit to a 5-year?
Oh, absolutely.
Term?
Mm-hmm. I do.
And is that enough? Do you think? Do you have any way of knowing?
No, I don't have any way of knowing. I do know that we're under a consent decree and it will take some time to move through the consent decree. I think that in all fairness, I believe that that would be proper. A 5-year contract would be proper, and then I think you would offer options for renewal.
So, as I mentioned, this delegation that included the City Council President and Brandon Scott, head of the Public Safety Committee, Sharon Middleton, and Robert Stokes from the City Council, they went to Fort Worth last week. They talked to 40 different people over a couple of days of visiting there. They will come back and eventually make their report with their notes from those meetings public at some point. Will Mr. Fitzgerald, Dr. Fitzgerald, have an opportunity to meet with the community and to discuss his plans? And what are those forums going to look like?
I think they're public forums that will be held. The council is holding public forums in the east and in the west.
Yeah, there's one on the 5th of January from 10 to 4 at City Hall. The other on the 7th of January at City Hall, which is just a City Council Executive Appointments Committee hearing that will be open to the public, but are you convinced that Dr. Fitzgerald will have ample opportunity to field questions from people in the community and get, you know, people in the community to know him the way that you've come to know him?
I think that what we'll do is make sure that he has an opportunity. We've gotten inquiries from different groups and organizations that will set up meetings for him so that he can know their will and their concerns, and, you know, everybody from the NAACP to BUILD and other organizations who are interested in sitting down with him, and we certainly will make that available to them as well.
One of your most important jobs as mayor is surrounding yourself with agency heads and people in your administration who are really top flight. You're looking for a new health commissioner. Dr. Nguyen, you know, is a person people had great respect for. And frankly, the city has a great track record of health commissioners. I mean, you think of Peter Bielenson and Joff Sharstein and now Lena Nguyen. But these decisions, these personnel decisions, are really crucial and difficult and complicated. What is it about Joel Fitzgerald that makes makes you confident that he's the right guy for the job?
Let me be real clear. There's no process that has ever taken place where Mayor Pugh has made the decision by herself. She's always asked for advisors. Even with the Parks and Recreation, with the Health Department, those decisions aren't solely made by me, and neither was this decision either. This was a review panel of 51 different individuals that people got to review and provide the information. The same thing with the Health Commissioner. We're going through, I think, 30 or 40 applications. There's a committee that's set up. They will send their recommendations to me, and I will make the selection. The same thing with the Parks and Recreation. We had over 30 applications. I had a panel of four or five people. They went through them, and they submitted the top five names to me. The same thing will happen with happens with every single position. I don't just sit down and just pull a name out of the hat or look at a bunch of resumes and say, this is the choice.
But when you get to that top three, what about when Joel Fitzgerald is one of three that people are taking a close look at, that people think have the, you know, the potential to be a good police commissioner for our city? What is it about Dr. Fitzgerald that made you say he's the guy?
Again, I think it's the information that you shared on the resume, the conversations that we've had around community policing, around the consent decree, around all of the technology that is needed, and community engagement that is important. As he always says when he talks, he said, it's about we. It's about how we work together, and that's an important word for me.
All right, we are going to take a break. Speaking of we got to take a break, and we will come right back. We will have more of Midday with the Mayor, with Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh. We will begin taking your calls and comments. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Maryland's Attorney General, Brian Frosch, the veteran Democrat and former state senator who was originally elected to the AG's office back in 2014, won re-election last month to another four-year term. We're going to talk about the state's lawsuits challenging the Trump administration's financial corruption and its attack on the Affordable Care Act and his stand on redistricting and other issues that are before the Attorney General's office. As a matter of fact, he's going to be in federal court tomorrow morning. The federal government has decided, based on the decision made last Friday in Texas about the Affordable Care Act, the federal government is trying to have the case against the Trump administration concerning the Affordable Care Act dismissed in federal court tomorrow. He'll be there first in the morning, and then he's going to come straight here and talk to us about it tomorrow afternoon. So Brian Frosch, my guest tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday with the Mayor, and my guest is Baltimore City Mayor Catherine Pugh. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. And you can ping us on Facebook where we are streaming our conversation. Madam Mayor, we have a email from Nicholas who says, what objective evidence is there that the Baltimore Police Department culture is improving? You mentioned the consent decree that we've been under now for a while. Do you have a sense that things are getting better, that
yes,
the department is starting to turn around even before a new commissioner is named?
Yeah. So, you know, we created this violence reduction initiative, and we wanted to see if, in fact, it would have an impact on reducing violence in the city. And so what I did was I put all of our commanders in the same room with members of our cabinet who were instructed to be able to act. You know, don't sit in the room if you can't act. And in those seven areas, and when we first started, you could see the skepticism in the room, and because I wanted to know if that interaction would make a difference, if conversations with each other in the room would make a difference.
Because you're talking about the police, the health department,
Public works, housing, all of them, late night licensing, the liquor folk, everybody's in the same room. The human services, homeless services, all of them are in the same room. Neighborhoods, everybody's in the same room. And when we started out, people were a little skeptical. And I think if you were sitting in that room today, and Tom, I invite you also to stop up and see how they interact. And
I'll do that.
In those seven areas, while we're still trending down in violence, we're nowhere near where I certainly would like to see us be. We're like down 10-11% in homicides and 6% in non-fatal shootings. But in those seven areas that we're concentrating in, 27% down in homicides, 24% in non-fatal shootings. And so the conversation this morning was, so what is it that we need to do as a city to scale up so that this reaches across the neighborhoods, across the community? And that's not all they talk about. They talk about their community engagements, everything from toy drives to feeding families to walking through neighborhoods and community engagement. So I see some of the change that's taken place, yes.
You know, Madam Mayor, the people that I talk to over the last couple of years, from activists in the community in some of our most afflicted neighborhoods to people in business and people in the who live in more affluent areas and have worked in the city and are supporters of the city, many of them supporters of you and your campaigns over the years, they say to me that the one thing that is just overwhelms every other conversation about the city is the perception of the crime mm-hmm. that's going on in our city. That's not a surprise to you, of course. I mean, they say no safety, no city.
Well, I think that, you know, one person, one life lost, and I say it all the time, one life lost is one life too many. And if you know somebody who's cousin, brother, sister, mother, anybody who has been shot or killed, you know, it impacts you in a very negative way. But the reality is that it is trending downward, you know, and it is a conversation that, you know, that people converse all the time, whether it is through the news media or the television or whatever. You know, in the morning, that's the first thing you hear. You don't hear about the Neighborhood Investment Fund or the $20 million Housing Trust Fund. You don't hear about crime trending downward. Those aren't the conversations that are had. Nobody talks about the Violence Reduction Initiative where violence is down 27% or 24%. That's not the conversation. So how you elevate what we're doing above those conversations is difficult, because when one person says it, then the other person believes it, and then somebody else believes it. And, you know, when you hear about it, it becomes your reality. And I understand that.
And it is a reality for many people, because it's not just people in our most afflicted neighborhoods now who know somebody who's been mugged or who's been carjacked or who's had an interaction that's been, you know, potentially fatal, even if it doesn't end up being fatal. I mean, there's a teacher who was carjacked in Fells Point the other day. There was a carjacking in Bolton Hill 3 days ago. There's a committee at a law firm downtown that has it's a safety committee. They meet regularly to talk about safety. One of their associates was accosted in the Inner Harbor and had her phone stolen. There's this notion that the city isn't a safe place to be. So the statistics say one thing,
but the data is real.
Yeah.
And, you know, this didn't happen just here or yesterday, or it happened last year. It happened a year before. You can look at the data. It's not like crime just started happening in our city. That's real.
Right.
You know, and so when you look at the real data, Tom, and we'll share the data with you. The reality is what the reality is. It's down 11% in homicides. It's down 7% in non-fatals. It's down 14% in robberies. It's down 27% in burglaries. I mean, that's real. That's 8%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's real.
But, so how do we get also to be real the perception that the city is safe? This is, of course, your phone going off. The whole world is calling you.
But it's the conversations that we have. We're not talking about Neighborhood Investment Fund. We're not talking about the Affordable Trust Act. We're not talking about the three new homeowners in the city. Those are real things that are happening in our city. And those aren't the conversations that's being had on the news or the radio or any of those things.
Comptroller Peter Franchot gave a talk to a group of business people 2 days ago down by BWI Airport, the BWI Business Partnership. And he says Baltimore needs a dramatic effort to bring back visitors to the city. They're afraid to go to restaurants. That's what he's hearing. So again, it's a perception. I'm downtown all the time. I live in Reservoir Hill. I'm downtown all the time.
So do you see people in the restaurants and so forth?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, then let's have those conversations.
But again, exactly. But how does one turn around that perception?
Peter Franchot doesn't live in Baltimore. So he doesn't get to go downtown to the restaurants at night, and he doesn't get to go to all of the venues and so forth that are in the city. So his perception is the same perception that's being echoed over the radio, in the newspaper, and not what's actually happening. You know, Baltimore is one of the top 10 cities for millennials to live in. They get it. You know, you build an apartment building downtown and they flood it before you can even get it done. We're building 200 new houses on Park Heights, and I'm telling you, people are already ready to move in. So, I mean, the reality is the reality, but the conversation begins with the media. It's your conversation. It's their conversation. It's what our newspapers and so forth write. They're not writing the good stories. They're not talking about the things. They're not talking about the 10 pools that are going to be renovated this summer. They're not talking about the $200 million that's being invested in Park Heights. They're not having those conversations, or the $52 million neighborhood investment fund. They're not talking about those kinds of things. That's not what you all talk about.
It's Midday with the Mayor. Mayor Catherine Pugh is certainly talking about those things, and you are welcome to talk with her about it. Midday's phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Madam Mayor, as is always the case when you come visit, you got lots of callers. Patricia in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Mayor Pugh.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Mayor.
Hi, how are you?
I think you're doing a great job in the city, by the way.
Thank you.
Not a millennial. I live in Baltimore, and I love it.
Thank you.
Well, I would like to ask you to tell us more about the Neighborhood Investment Fund. Okay. And, you know, how do we get involved in it?
Okay.
How can I learn more about it so I can bring it into my neighborhood to help my neighborhood?
Okay. Thanks for that question, Patricia. That's on my list,
Patricia,
as well.
Patricia, thank you for not being a millennial, but living in our city and loving our city. So So let me just tell you how it came about. So when I first came into City Hall, there was a deal on my desk to sell off garages. And in 1972, we sold off our airport. We sold our airport. Friendship Airport at that time was the name of a BWI. We sold it for $36 million. And I decided that we weren't selling garages. I said, instead of selling them, I said, why don't you lease them? Could you imagine in 1972 if we had to lease the airport as opposed to selling the airport, what that would mean to the city of Baltimore today? Because the airport in Atlanta is what economic development is all about. But we didn't make that choice. And so I made the choice not to sell the garages, but to lease them and to maintain ownership so that we can continue to derive revenue from them. And then we were able to capitalize them. So I capitalized them and floated bonds, and we raised $80 million, paid off the debt on the garages, and put $52 million into a neighborhood investment fund. Because what I said was, I want to invest in neighborhoods and communities that have been underinvested in for decades. Neighborhoods like Park Heights, like Sandtown, like Drew Heights, like East Baltimore. And then we put another $2 million into a capacity building operating fund for community associations that they could apply for grants. We'll start giving those grants out next year. We'll give them out every single year. And then another $3 million to support capital projects for community development corporations.
So now, are those grants? Are they loans?
How do
developers
grants,
get a hold of
the
that?
The community catalysts are grants. That's $5 million worth of grants that community organizations and CDCs will be able to apply for. And so they can apply for them through the Housing and Community Development Office here in Baltimore.
So give us an idea of the kinds of things that they would do with that money. These are the community development corporations.
Well, what community development corporations
labor,
do is what community development corporations do in some cases is they buy up boarded up houses in their neighborhoods, or they'll repair roofs in their neighborhoods and their communities. They do all kinds of things in their neighborhoods.
So we're talking structural stuff in residences.
They can do structural things in their neighborhoods. They may fix, they may create community gardens. It's whatever they want to do with them. So they're vying with others. And then the $52 million will be leveraged to help us to build housing and repair housing in neighborhoods and communities, along with the $75 million that we get in core money. And I think if you go up in Park Heights, it's a perfect example of where we've torn down 60 acres of boarded up houses, and we are now redeveloping houses in neighborhoods. And there are 38 houses on Park Heights that we can actually just refurbish and make available for people in the neighborhoods and communities. Directly across.
What are those houses going to sell for example?
So
are you talking about renting them or selling them to
so
homeowners?
So, give you an example. Pimlico Elementary and Middle School off of Pimlico Road, directly across the street from that particular development, were boarded up houses. And we said, that's not what we want people in the community to see when they come out the door. And so we laid the foundation for those houses and then lured a developer there to rehab those houses. And they will mortgage at now $600 to $700 a month, which is less than the rents that many people are paying. The Habitat for the Humanity houses that work with the city in Sandtown, we just refurbished three of those. Their mortgages are $500, no interest.
Let's go to Nicole in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Mayor Pugh.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just like to agree with Mayor Pugh that the praises of the city are not sung enough, and Mr. Franchot's comment that the restaurants are empty are indeed not true. My husband and I are residents of the city. We're raising our daughter in the city, and we're restaurant owners in our neighborhood. And we get a great crowd on the nights that we're open. So it's just completely false. It's a false narrative that people aren't going out in the city and that they're not enjoying what the city has to offer.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Nicole. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nicole.
Let's go to Michael in Baltimore. Michael, welcome to Midday with Mayor Pugh.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Ms. Mayor, I have a question. I've noticed in the wealthy neighborhoods like Roland Park and Guilford and to East South Point, areas like that, the streets are maintained. The trash cans are emptied. I mean, they look beautiful. There's bike lanes. But as soon as you cross the dividing line into a less wealthy neighborhood, the bike lanes disappear. The streets have potholes. There's garbage everywhere. I'm wondering, how can we divide the city's resources more equitably to better help those who are less advantaged?
Okay. All right. Thanks for that call, Michael.
Thank you for that question. So that's what the $52 million investment fund is for. And in fact, we have a program with the Department of Transportation. It's 48 hours. You can get a pothole fixed. So go to the DOT and you'll see that that program does operate. And we're building 125 miles of bike lanes throughout the city, throughout neighborhoods and communities. It's just like, unlike what some cities have done with the little bikes that you see, the Limes and the scooters, ours are going all across the city in four neighborhoods as well, on Pennsylvania Avenue, wherever you want to look, they are there. And as it relates to garbage and stuff, when I talk about those seven concentrated areas, those are in neighborhoods and communities that have been underserved for decades. We're even adding another overnight crew just so that we can clean up areas and neighborhoods and communities. But the fact of the matter is that trash doesn't get on the ground by itself. You know, one of the things that we're doing now is walking neighborhoods and communities where community group leaders are meeting with us and sharing with us sites where people have been dumping for decades. And so we're putting up additional cameras. Working with Comcast, we're putting up 100 more cameras throughout the city so that we can look at some of these areas where people continue to come and dump. And they're not necessarily people who live in Baltimore. People come to the city, dump their stuff, and there are people who don't realize that we've got places that you can actually take your trash to.
Bella Luna comments on Facebook, what is, this is another question about Dr. Fitzgerald, what is Fitzgerald's buyout? Is it in line with previous commissioners?
1 year. It's way in line with everybody else's. We haven't even begun to, well, be honest with you, we haven't even begun to discuss contract yet. There is a process that he must go through, and we'll discuss that afterwards. But we will make sure that we keep the city's coffers in mind as well.
Of course, and of course, the confirmation process will start next month when the city council reconvenes after the holiday. Marcia comments on Facebook, I bought a home in the city 2 months ago, and we go out to eat, we go to shows. It's fabulous here, and I feel wise to have chosen Baltimore. So you got another fan in Marcia. Nicholas says, if in 10 years Baltimore had the highest achieving unsegregated public schools in the world, what would that process look like? It would be increased funding and what?
Well, let me just say that, you know, I am very supportive of Kerwin, and I'm supportive of the new formula for
this.
This
is the Kerwin Commission that's recommending a major investment,
a major overhaul
the state.
Of the school system. I can tell you that we're on target now to build 28 new schools in Baltimore. That's more than the entire state of Maryland. But we need to build more because we have the oldest stock in the state. And I think that will go a long way in equaling opportunities for our young people because we don't have the computer systems that we should have straight across the board. And we're working very hard to improve technology. I don't get to run the school system. It is run by the CEO and the board of directors of the school system. But we work hand in hand to make sure that we're supporting the system. And he's right. If we can get this right, if we get the school system right, it will not only improve education for all of our young people across the board. You know, people move to cities for two basic reasons with children. That is to maintain that they have a good school system and the city is safe. And so we're working on both those ends.
It's Midday with the mayor. Mayor Catherine Pugh, the Baltimore City mayor, is with us here for the hour. We'll have more with the mayor when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. If you want to drop us an email, it's midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Today, it's Midday with the mayor. The mayor of Baltimore City, Catherine Pugh, is my guest. The city council is planning two public hearings to discuss the nomination of Dr. Joel Fitzgerald to be the next police chief here in Baltimore. People will have a chance to offer testimony about Dr. Fitzgerald on Saturday, January 5th at City Hall. The council will hear testimony all day, 10 to 4 that day. And then on Monday, the 7th of January at 5 o'clock, members of the city council will testify and question Dr. Fitzgerald in an open hearing of the Executive Appointments Committee. We'll have a link to information about that on the WYPR Midday website. If you have a question or a comment for Mayor Pugh right now until the top of the hour, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go back, Madam Mayor, if you wouldn't mind. We're going to go back to the phones to Matt in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Mayor Pugh.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mayor Pugh. I actually had a question regarding the nomination of Mr. Fitzgerald. I know that there have been some questions raised regarding redactions in his background report by some of the members of the City Council, and I just wanted to ask Mayor Pugh if she had any concerns regarding that, and if she can offer the city of Baltimore any assurances that no skeletons in the closet will surface one or two or any number of years into the future regarding that background report.
Okay, so I want to share with you what was redacted. I have it right here. His Social Security number. Okay, it goes through and it says, our criminal investigation reveals no entries concerning Mr. Fitzgerald. So I'm showing this to Tom, his Social Security number. Redacted.
All like of the credit card numbers and stuff are redacted. They're
so I just want you to see you're looking at this. Here, his driver's license number.
Right.
His expiration date of his driver's license number. And it says DMV records reflect no violations within the last 3 years reported to law. And then here it says county where he lives, his address is redacted.
Are there plans to make this report public?
Let me finish. It says there is no evidence of delinquent taxes owed by the candidate. And, of course, as you just pointed out, his credit card numbers are redacted. But it also says here that Mr. Fitzgerald is current on all these debts. There are no other redactions.
Yeah, no. Almost all of the report is not redacted.
Right.
Would it be a good idea, do you think, to release that report with the redactions to the public? I mean, the city council is going to get it.
The city council gets it, and I think that's where it belongs.
Let me ask you about recruiting in the police department. This is something you and I have talked about the last several times that you've been here. Baltimore City Council President Jack Young, just a couple days ago, said that the police department was stonewalling, that was his word, in terms of city auditors releasing data about the agency's performance recruiting new members. I mean, police recruitment is something that you've been very, very much a champion of, and you've expressed some concern, for example, this weird constitutional setup we have where the state actually has certain controls over the city police department. But where are we with recruiting? Where are we with numbers in terms of the
state doesn't control the recruiting of the police department. What happens is...
Well, they dictate training and numbers of months that people must be trained.
Right, but that's for the entire state. That's every police department across the state. Mm-hmm. They dictate that you have to do X amount of training. Every police officer has to go through 10 and a half months of training. That's the state's requirement. The recruitment, when we first got here, the big issue was that recruitment was you had to walk down to the police department, you had to fill out an application. And so the police department was getting something like 50 applications a month. And so I didn't understand the lack of technology, as I pointed out to you one time before when I was here, that when I got to Baltimore as its mayor, I learned that we didn't even have computers in our police cars. In 1997, they started putting computers in police cars in Montgomery County, Prince George's County, Anne Arundel County, Baltimore County, everywhere but Baltimore City. I don't know why we didn't do it, but I did as soon as I got here. So all of our police cars now have computers in them. I point that out because there was no technology being utilized in the police department. And so we put the application online. When we put the application online, Tom, we now get 60 to 70 applications a week. But because...
And is that about the goal? I mean, is 60 to 70 applications a week going to end up with enough people going to the academy, graduating, and coming onto the force?
If 10% of that, which would be 3,500, if 10% of those got through, we would have more. We would have what we need. I think the issue for us as it relates to policing is that nobody has taken time to really analyze where we were in the police department. For example, I can go back and show you that we've not had 2,800 officers in our police department since 2000 and, well, for the last 7 years. In fact, nobody paid any attention to the attrition rate, how many officers we were losing, and how many officers we were hiring. We averaged about 2,400 officers a year in our police department, which meant that we already had a void of 400 police officers for the last 7 years.
And the department, like many other departments, because Baltimore is certainly not the only department that faces this challenge, but, you know, it's getting older, and so people are retiring, and it's very difficult, find people to replace
them. No, you don't. Not if you do what we did. We put the application online. You went from 50 a month to 60 to 70 applications a week. That's almost 3,500 applications a year. And so if you were processing those applications, you can surely find enough officers to fill the void that we have not filled in decades. And so what I've said is that we've got to expand our training, which is now why we're talking with Coppin State University, because the capacity of train where we currently are about 240, which means that we don't get to fill the void. You've got a void of 400. You've got an attrition rate that we've gotten down from. When I first walked in the door, it was at 300 a year. We're now down to something like 200. Right now, 143 this year. And so we've got to fill for the attrition rate, but you got to fill the void, which means that you've got to be training. If you want to get to where you need to be, you've got to be training something like 350 to 400 officers a year.
So you seem confident about those numbers, but a couple of days ago, City Council President Young didn't seem at all confident. He says that the department is not returning phone calls to Audrey Askew, who's the auditor. You know that they're not trusting the numbers that they're getting from the department.
Well, I haven't had that conversation with the president. The president and I have a very good relationship. I've shared with him these numbers, and I think that, again, I don't think there's been the analysis of the police department that I've done. 545 officers lost before I even came into the department, 545 positions that should be filled. And when you freeze hiring of police officers, the only thing you do is create a top-heavy organization, and you don't have boots on the ground. We need people in patrol. So I've sat down with the Fraternal Order of Police, the new head of the Fraternal Order of Police, Mancuso, and talked to him about creating patrol 1, 2, 3, 4 so that we can get folks staying on patrol for a period of time, incentivize those folks to stay there, because we need folks in our neighborhoods, in our communities, engaging with the public, and more importantly, providing that safety that people want in our neighborhoods and our communities.
Do you want to comment on a story that ran in the Sun today? Kevin Rector wrote it for the Baltimore Sun about the ATF task force that was disjoining itself from members of
they're
the...
They're not disjoining themselves. I talked with the commissioner this morning. There were some folks who, they've separated some people. They've also backfilled those positions, and so they will continue to work with ATF. ATF is important to the city. We've asked them to come in. They've been here. They've been working with us, as has the state police, has the school police, also has the sheriff's department, also has the transit police. Everybody's working together to try to help Baltimore become better and safer.
ATF, of course, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which seems like a weird coupling of those three things. On the other hand, you got bars you can go to and drink and throw axes, so anything's possible here. It's America.
I should say to you, too, that our... buyback gun program. Mm-hmm. We started it yesterday on Pennsylvania Avenue at Shake and Bake. We collected over 540 some odd arms, guns that we took off the street. We will convene again tomorrow on Mumford Street in Baltimore at a community center, and we'll have three. So we're trying to get as many guns off of our streets as we possibly can.
Yeah, you're offering between $25 and even as much as $500 for the
gun. Got to get them off
the streets. Speaking of Shake and Bake, the bowling alley is about to be done.
The bowling alley is about to open up this spring, so we're very excited about that. You know, I closed it down. I think that was one of our first conversations. We closed it down. And we opened it back up
For
the skating part. So we fixed the floor. We have 500 pairs of brand new skates there, brand new floor, air conditioning, brand new roof, community meeting rooms. And now I think 70% of the bowling lanes weren't working. So we'll open back up in the spring. Brand new bowling lanes, and we're very excited about that.
Shake and Bake, a historic location on Pennsylvania Avenue. Let's see if we can sneak in one more call, Madam Mayor. Yvonne in Baltimore, you've been very patient. I appreciate it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Madam Mayor. I want to thank you for being creative in choosing our new police commissioner, number one.
Thank you.
Number two, I am so happy that you had the opportunity to let us know what so many great things that are going on in the city. We really needed to hear that. Tom, I challenge you and the radios and the TV to start talking about positive things that are occurring in Baltimore. And I thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for that call, Yvonne. I appreciate it. And tune in every day. And I think you are going to hear us talking about some things. We just had a conversation about sports programs for after school that are working with playing soccer and playing hockey and playing squash and riding dirt bikes and learning about physics and stuff. So we do try to talk about the good things that are going on in the city. But again, you have a tough job, Madam Mayor. It's this perception.
And let me just say thank you to Yvonne. And you're absolutely right. But I can tell you there have been 10 pools in this city that have been closed for decades. And we're repairing them all in this summer. Young people will get to swim for free in the neighborhood and community pools. Cherry Hill, we're building a brand new recreation center. Again, 28 more new schools, 20 some odd more new schools being built in our city. The Neighborhood Investment Fund, I think people will see the transition that's taking place in our neighborhoods and communities. And the community engagement is essential to how we continue to do police work in our city, and I'm excited. Thank you.
One last call from Jim in Baltimore. Welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Hi, Jim. You're on the air. What's your real quick question for Madam Mayor?
The property at Pimlico Racetrack has been a matter of discussion for 20, 30 years now. I was wondering if there were any thoughts of purchasing the property from the private owners and trying to hold on to it like we didn't do with the airport.
All right. Thanks for that call, Jim. Of course, there's a $424 million plan to renovate Pimlico.
Thank you, Jim. That's a great question. And I can tell you that there are plans in terms of keeping the Preakness in Baltimore. There are a lot of conversations around the ownership of the track. So I don't want to say too much until after I've met with the owners, but Baltimore is very excited about keeping the Preakness in Baltimore. And just like you said, we've got to think creatively. You know, it's not about how we get rid of something. It's about how we enhance it. And building a venue inside of the venue, I think, is very great for Baltimore.
Shopping and all that kind of stuff.
And making more use of the track.
Racetrack.
Mm-hmm. Making more uses of the track itself. But, you know, a place for weddings and all kinds of things can happen right there at the Pimlico Racetrack.
Yeah, the Maryland State Authority did issue a report called for spending about $424 million. It doesn't say where that money's going to come from, so we will stay on top of
that. But I think Jim is on top of it. It's about being creative and private sector public partnerships. We'll make it work.
Mayor Catherine Pugh is the mayor of Baltimore City. Madam Mayor, happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Always fun to see you.
Thank you, happy holidays to Baltimore as well. Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch will be my guest. We'll be discussing a host of issues on the AG's plate, including the response response to last Friday's Texas court ruling that struck down the Affordable Care Act, as well as the state's other lawsuits against the Trump administration. That is all coming up tomorrow on Midday. Lunch for our guests today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Finally, we say goodbye today to Jacob Took. He's a student at Johns Hopkins University, and he's been helping us out this semester as an intern here at Midday, so we appreciate your help, Jacob, and we wish you the best as you continue your education. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.